This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Ice Cube Award, Learning to Be Cool Under Pressure. And the author is Midge Noble, and Midge joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. This interview brought to everyone by Balboa Press. Hello, Midge.
Hi, nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you with us. This is a fun story with a great message, a lot of good insight into helping people, especially young people, with their temper, their anger. Let me read this first before we start talking about the details. You say Ice Cube Award is an action-packed story about Danny, a young girl who lives in Ice Town. Danny has a serious, destructive anger problem. When Danny feels angry, she generates so much heat that it starts things to melt, like the floors in the grocery store, the church pew, her sister's crib, and the final straw, the statue of the mayor. Danny has to learn how to control her anger or her family will be thrown out of town. Well, that's what you do. You get rid of people like that. They get hot, right? And it's not a great place to be hot in Ice Town.
That's right. If you've got an anger problem, don't move there.
Don't move to Ice Town. A great idea, Midge. Tell us a little bit about your background and then how you came up with this and why you decided to publish your book.
Well, I'm a licensed professional counselor. I live in North Carolina, and I've actually worked in the counseling field since 1985. I work mostly with children and some adolescents, and predominantly with kids who have lived through trauma, divorce, neglect, foster care, and adoption. And many of the kids that I work with have had anger problems, and it's no surprise that they are angry about their situation, and sometimes they come from families that are not functioning in very healthy ways. And so anger is a cover-up emotion for us. When we're sad or insecure, anger is the most powerful emotion that we can come up with that acts itself out instead of, you know, focusing on what we really feel. So I wanted to write a book that would be helpful to kids that I've worked with. And the book was actually inspired by one of my former clients who had a huge anger problem and had destroyed my office on more than one occasion. And one day I asked this client if they would draw a picture of themselves once the anger was under control and how they might look and how they might feel. And he did that, and he brought the picture to me, and he had this big goofy grin on his face and this necklace around his neck. And I said, well, tell me a little bit about this picture. And he said, well, this is me being happy, like you said. I'm like, okay, that's great. And I said, and tell me about this necklace. And he said, well, that's my ice cube. And I said, and what's that for? And he said, to keep me cool. And as soon as he said this, the idea of the book popped into my head, and I told him, I said, man, I said, that would make the best story, and it could go something like this. And he says, well, then I should be in the book. And I laughed with him, and I said, well, you know, you can't be in the book because you're my client, and I can't breach confidentiality. I said, but I promise you, I said, if I ever write this book, I said, I will dedicate the book to you. And about a month later, he actually died in a house fire. And so it took me several years to actually get around to writing the book. But in the beginning of the book, I do dedicate it to him. And it says, to a special young boy whose light burned out too early, but before he left this earth, he had earned his own Ice Cube Award. And I thank him for his inspiration. So that's why I wrote the book. I wanted to not only dedicate this to his memory, but also to help other children who are going through that type of thing.
Ice Cube Award, it's an uplifting and empowering story. You're trying to teach kids that no problem is too big to overcome.
Right, and I do believe that. I believe that anything that we're going through has a purpose. and it's going to help us either become the person we are created to be, or it's going to inspire someone else. And everything has a solution. It really doesn't matter what it is. If you are able to line yourself up with your true calling, with loving yourself and approving of yourself, everybody else's opinion of you, everybody else's belief about you really doesn't matter in the long run. What really matters is what you believe. And if you believe that you're going to be able to do something, you will. If you believe you're going to become something, you will. So I want kids to know that, you know, the first place is to start to love and approve of yourself. And then if other people are bullying you, if other people are trying to put you down for anything, you know, their voices don't have to get inside your head. You know, you have ownership of that.
So we find out, we are introduced to Dani, and she says, I live in Icetown. Everything is made of ice, which is really cool, unless you have an anger problem like I do. So tell us a little about Dani and some of the fixes she gets in.
Well, Dani, bless her heart, is just one of those kids that just doesn't like it when she's told no. She doesn't like it when things don't go her way or the way she expects them to go. So in the story, she does overreact to almost everything that happens. For example, you know, she wants her favorite candy bar Crunch Blasters, and her mom is in a rush and needs to get to church, and she tells her no. Well, Dani, like some children, will go ahead and test the limits, and she went to get it anyway. And when her mom stayed firm and told her no, Danny's anger starts to get hot, and her face flushes, and everything, you know, starts to heat up, and she melts the store floor, and they have to rush out as the clerk is rushing behind them with the mop to clean up the damage. She gets mad in church because her best friend doesn't sit with her, and in Icetown everything's made of ice, and so there goes the church pew melting all around them. Every situation she gets into, she gets hot and melts something. And of course the very last straw was when she melted the face of the statue of the mayor, and that's what brought her to that predicament that, you know, you're going to have to move out if things continue this way. But not only is Dani, you know, somewhat of a bully herself by destroying property, she's also bullied by her arch nemesis at school, who bullies her and pushes her out of swings and grabs things out of her hand. So it's sort of like she plays both roles in this story. She has an anger problem and bullies, and she's also being bullied and reacts in anger to that.
And, of course, in Icetown, they have a department, the refreezing department.
Yes, when she gets really ticked off at school after Jane grabbed the crayons out of her hand, there goes the walls in the school, and the teacher is trying to grab books and kids, and in comes the refreezing crew to refreeze the walls. But when she does the statue of the mayor, the police says, you know, you're going to have to pay for that refreezing. You know, the consequences start to build up.
Yes, I'm calling your parents tonight.
Whoops,
that's for sure. So, anger management, bullying, believing in yourself, the themes that run through the book.
Yes. Yes. I hope that what kids will take away from this is an understanding that, you know, anger is something that we feel, and it is something that we're going to feel. We can't just erase the emotion of anger, but what we can do is learn how to look inside and make choices, how to calm ourselves down, how to look at somebody's comments about us in a different way. You know, when Dani is faced with having to deal with those issues with the bully, she learns through the book how to listen to her inner voice, you know, and calm herself down and take the teasing in a humorous way or just not react to it at all. So she empowers herself to take control of those thoughts and those feelings.
So every person is worthy to be loved by themselves and others.
Correct. And the love has to start, I believe, with ourselves. You know, there are so many children that I work with that everybody is telling them, you know, you're really good and you're really pretty and you're really this and you're really that. But if they don't believe it, it's just, you know, it's almost like that old Charlie Brown thing, want, 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 want. You know, the words aren't getting in because they're not embracing their own divinity or their own belief about themselves. So, you know, it really does have to start with themselves, and then they can then branch that out to other people.
If children are bullied in school, what should they do?
Well, I think the first thing that they need to do is let an adult know. The thing that really worries me in the school systems today is that they may have a zero tolerance for bullies and bullying. But I hear a lot of kids saying, I told my teacher and nothing happened. But, you know, I do believe that if they just keep it to themselves, you know, that sets them up for internalizing and sometimes taking their own life. So I do believe the first thing that they have to do is let some adult know. And if the first adult they tell doesn't do anything about it, they need to keep telling adults in their lives until someone supports them. The second thing that they need to do is understand that just because they're being bullied doesn't mean that they're not worthy. You know, the other child who's bullying you has a set of problems, or they wouldn't have been engaging in that type of activity. So, yes, you know, let adults know, get support for yourself, don't be in it by yourself, but understand that being called a certain name or being put down doesn't make it true for you. It's somebody else's perception of you at that moment, but that doesn't mean that that's who you really are.
We have to talk about the illustrations.
Okay.
They're wonderful.
The illustrations were actually done by my cousin out of Virginia. Her name is Candy Noble Wallace, and she is an amazing artist. I had actually written a previous book called Sheba, Home is Where Your Heart Is, and that book is about a real-life dog that lived with me. And the illustrations were just spot on. I mean, she could not have done a better job. So when I asked her about doing the Ice Cube Award, she was a little bit concerned that she had always done portraits of real life animals, and this is more of a cartoon kind of book, and so she was very concerned. But the illustrations that she did are absolutely hilarious, and the melting walls and the shocked faces and the name calling pictures were at one point Danny is called a chicken head, so there's Danny with a chicken head on her body, and it's just really great art. Candy is an amazing artist, and I'm just so tickled that we've been able to do these projects together.
What support systems would you like to see put in place to help children deal with bullying?
That's a very good question. I would love to see the schools or our communities, when they say zero tolerance, I want them to stand behind that. I want there to be a system in place where when a child brings a situation to an adult's attention, that they can't just say it'll be all right or don't worry about it or get over it. I want that report to be so serious that something is done about it right then, or at least within that day, that somebody is following up with the child who is being bullied and following up with the person who is doing the bullying. I see so many kids change their lives where the victim stops riding the bus because the bully's still on the bus. Or a child switches a classroom because the bully's in the classroom and they can't, you know, control this one child. So I would like the system to be that the bully has to have some consequences for what they're doing and get some therapy, get some help, find out how to surround this family with support so that that family that may not be functioning in a healthy way gets healthier, so that that child who is reacting in anger, you know, can live their healthy life. So I just think that we have to be a little bit more aggressive when it comes to managing the actual bullying and not having the victim always be lost in the report, you know, that something needs to be done to support the victim, and the consequences need to be on the bully side instead of the victim side.
Ice Cube Award, Learning to Be Cool Under Pressure. The author is Midge Noble. Midge, give us some closing thoughts and then tell us how to get your book.
Okay. Well, I guess my closing thought would be that every child is important, and every life on this earth is important, and we are all worthy. And I want children to know that even if you're going through difficult times, and even if things aren't working out the way you want them to right now, hold on, because bad things don't last forever, and sad things don't last forever. And your life is going to be worth living in the end. And I hope every child will take that and understand that they are going to have a great life if they really want it. My book is available at Balboa Press. in the bookstore. It's also available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. And they can also access more information about the book and order it from my website, which is MidgeNobleSecondChances.com.
Midge, thanks for being with us on Indie Book Publishing. This interview brought to everyone by Balboa Press. Thank you, Midge.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a delightful time. Thank you.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Get ready to live La Bella Vita with Dawn Catherine on TogiNet.com. Live La Bella Vita. If you're wanting to know all the beauty tricks of the trade and the latest fashion trends before everyone else, this is your show. If you admire celebrities' beauty and their fashion sense, this is your show. Do you love wine and want to know more about the process it takes to make wine from the vine to the bottle? This is your show. Live La Bella Vita. For more on the show and your host, check out our website, LaBellaVitaCosmetico.com. This is the kind of show you can sink your teeth into. If you enjoy traveling and food and family, all with an Italian flair, then you can live La Bella Vita with your host, Dawn Catherine. Wednesday nights at midnight, 11 p.m. Central on TogiNet.com.
Mark Lipinski is coming to TogiNet. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, a live two-hour show Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on TogiNet.com. Creative Mojo. It's fun, entertaining, informative, inspirational, and illuminating. Lipinski has worked on such shows as Oprah, The View, The Joan Rivers Show, and Ricky Lake. He's busy, but he's got the drive to share with Creative Mojo, dedicated to the modern crafter and crafting lifestyle. Dive into the info and enjoy everything from celebs to entertainment news to recipes, quilting and needlework, knitting, painting, woodworking, Christmas crafts, and so much more. This show boldly encourages you to discover and harness your own creative spirit by living creatively every day. For more on Mark and the show, check out marklipinski.com. Don't miss the fun. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on TogiNet.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, If You Think It, and the author is Linda Sauge. And Linda joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Linda.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Well, great to have you with us, Linda. I'm going to read a few things which you have written just so everyone understands a little bit more about If You Think It. You say it's a collection of timeless and timely quotations on a subject all great philosophers agree on. The single most important determinant in creating a quality life, achieving success in any endeavor, and living the life of your dreams. And it's simply this. Each thought has the power to impact your life positively or negatively, and at every moment, you decide. Well, that just sums it up. We are what we think, aren't we?
That's so true, Steve.
Well, tell us a little bit about your background, Linda, and what motivated you to publish this book.
I love quotations. I have always collected them, the quotes that inspire me or motivate me. And over the years, I just noticed how many philosophers, writers, poets, scientists had expressed in a different way this same idea that our thoughts create our life. Our life moves in the direction of our thoughts. And I just started compiling them. And over time, it became very powerful to me because I saw this being true in my own life, that I'm a naturally optimistic and positive person, but that, I think, is a result of how I think. Not a result of all the events in my life, but I bring that positive viewpoint by what I focus on and what I think. So my interpretation of events happens to be positive because I have a positive outlook. So what we think is what we attract into our lives. So this started out just as an exercise in collecting quotes, and it has evolved into a philosophy of my life.
Well, and a philosophy that's helped you a great deal. You've been through some challenging experiences like most people go through. Tell us a little bit about the influence, though, of your father and your husband on this philosophy.
Well, that was, I had experienced two very serious situations, life-threatening situations with my father and my husband, and watching how their thoughts impacted them and our family was an affirmation of this teaching. My father, when he was 54 years old, became ill one night with the flu, ended up driving himself to the emergency room in the middle of the night, and by 8 o'clock in the morning, he was paralyzed from the chest down. A virus had attacked his spine and left him paralyzed. And he never walked again. He lived like that for another 20 years. He was in a wheelchair. And he was a person who was so inspiring to us because literally overnight his life changed. The circumstances of his life changed. He had to learn how to live again completely in a disabled way. But he never pitied himself. He refused to feel like he was a victim or feel sorry for himself. So he was just a great inspiration. He had a great attitude. And through his attitude, he was able to create so much happiness and joy in our family. It was, you know, of course it was tragic and it was difficult. There were many adjustments that had to be made. But he just was positive. If this was what happened to him, he was going to make the best of it. This was a new chapter in his life, one he didn't expect, one he never would have wanted, but he had the choice. He had the choice to either be miserable and unhappy, and then all of what that creates around you, all of that kind of difficulty, or just accept it. So that was one instance where I observed this teaching in action, you know, because it's one thing to have a philosophy intellectually, but when you are living it, it's very inspiring. Then a few years after that, after my dad became ill, my husband also became ill. He had AIDS. And in that disease, there is progressive deterioration. In the last year of his life, almost every day, I could see some skill deteriorating. His vision getting worse, his hearing getting worse, his motor skills getting worse. And every time he lost a skill, he never complained. He always looked at what was left, not what he had lost. And he was a sun worshiper, but he could no longer go in the sun because of medications he was on. So instead of complaining about that, he changed to a sunset worshiper, and where he could go outside when the sun was setting. And he was an avid reader, and when he could no longer read, he used to say, "I'm so grateful for music." And so instead of complaining about what he had lost, he had gratitude for what was left. At the very end, he started to lose his motor skills, and it was difficult for him to hold on to things. And so he took Velcro strips and lined silverware, cups, glasses with Velcro so that they wouldn't slip through his hands. To this day, we have the crock pot where he took Velcro around the the handle of the cover, and that's sort of our family heirloom, this crock pot with Velcro on the cover. But again, an example of someone who had difficulty but chose to look at what was right, chose the focus, chose the attitudes that would make his life as good as possible, even under these circumstances. And I think you can imagine how easy it would be to be bitter, to be angry in both of these situations, to be negative, to be critical. But when you bring that attitude and outlook to a situation, that feeds on itself, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that you do become more miserable, you do see more negative things and bring more negative things into your life. So it seems backwards, because you would think that having those experiences would shape your attitude, but it's really the reverse. It's your attitude and your thoughts that shape your life.
Why do so many just resort to blame, and thus it seems to immobilize them?
I think that's the message that I want people to see in this book and to be inspired by. I think it's so important to fill your mind with positive thoughts and ideas, because I think it is natural to blame, to look for things that are negative, because there is a lot of things that you can interpret several ways, and if you interpret them negatively, then that feeds on itself. So I don't know why people do that. I think people do have a natural disposition, and I have a natural disposition to be positive and optimistic, and I think some people do have a disposition to be critical and negative and blame, but it makes you so powerless when you're at the effect of things, and you really have the power to choose. We all have the power to choose how we're going to view a situation. And that's why two people can look at the same situation or have the exact same experience, watch the same movie, and have a completely different opinion or experience, because it's what you bring that informs your opinions and your viewpoints.
The title of her book is If You Can Think It. Well, let's look at some of these quotations from famous people throughout history, modern, ancient. Let's look at some of these and some of your favorite. Let's read them one at a time and then maybe make some comments. There's some 140, more than 140 quotations, one per page, so it's the kind of thing, right, Linda, that you want people just to read and ponder and start their day, maybe end their day as well.
I do, because I think every single one of these quotations is an entire philosophy. It's a book. It is. Steve, I have so many favorite quotes. It's going to be hard to just pick out a few, but an ancient one is by the Buddha. And it sums up what we've been talking about. And he said, "We are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make our world." Very simple, but that philosophy just pervades history from, I have quotes from 500 years before Christ right up to the present. You know, a present-day quote expressing that in a little different way is by Louise Hay. And she said, "The thoughts you are thinking and the words you are declaring at this moment are creating your future." And James Allen, British philosopher and poet, said, "We think in secret and it comes to pass. Our world is but our looking glass." And I love that idea of our world is the way we filter what we see through our thoughts.
Somebody might say, how can you be so positive when there's so much suffering and tragedy everywhere in the world?
Well, there is, and we can't deny that there are sad things personally, sad things in our world, but I feel that I want to, I can't ignore that, and it is a reality, but I don't have to focus on that. I could think, I could try to find something positive in any situation, and if I can't find something positive in the situation, is there something around it? Is there something else that I can do to make things positive?
Do you ever get accused of being just a Pollyanna?
I do, and I take that as a compliment.
Oh, that's great. Yes. Now, there's power, and that's the one thing that we have got to understand. There is power in our thoughts because thoughts precede action.
There is power in our thoughts. I always feel that we are moving in a direction. If you have the thought that you can't do something or that something is never going to happen, you are not going to take any action to move toward it happening. You know, Henry Ford said, if you think you can or if you think you can't, you're right. The power in our thoughts is that if you are moving toward a goal or you have a vision of something happening and you're positive about it, you are going to move toward that because you're going to take the actions that would be necessary to achieve or fulfill that. If you start out thinking, this is never going to happen, I'm not good at this, or whatever negative thought you're going to have about something, you're going to be right because you're not going to take the actions to make something happen, and you're going to focus and filter, you know, that idea that the world is but our looking glass. You're going to focus and filter all the evidence to prove that you're right, that you can't do that or you can't have that. So I always say if you have the choice, and we do have the choice, to think positively or negatively, why in the world would you think negatively? Why not at least try to set it up for yourself that you can move in that positive direction?
So it's a discipline. We've got to practice this. We've got to do what you say. You know, and your book is perfect for this. Your book gives us this roadmap every day. Read this quote and ponder it and think about it and turn it into action.
That's right. Very important to fill your mind with good, positive thoughts, just the way you fill your body with good, healthy food. It's all connected. And so our mind-body is connected, and you want to fill it with good and positive energy.
And that's why you say, if you think it, the title of your book, and there's the completion of the thought, so shall it be. Well, Linda, tell us how to get your book.
My book is available at any of the online retailers, Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and you can go to my website, www.ifyouthinkit.com.
Linda, thanks for being with us on Indie Book Publishing. This interview brought to everyone by Balboa Press. Thank you, Linda.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Want to be challenged in a powerful way to leap beyond what you think is possible? Then join us Mondays for the Leah Jansen Show. Every Monday at 10 a.m., 9 a.m. Central on TogiNet.com with Leah Jansen. Listen live as life coach Leah uses her coaching skills to give you the tools you need to take action and create momentum. You are encouraged to call in and share your greatest fears, challenges, and obstacles, and then listen as Leah obliterates those barriers to success. For more on Leah and the show, check out her website, leahjansen.com. That's Leah, LeahJansen.com. Spend 1 hour with Leah, and you'll be captivated by her energy, enthusiasm, and magnetism. You'll quickly become addicted to her positive attitude and make-it-happen mentality. Ready for a life-changing, mood-altering show? Then get ready for Leah Jansen. And listen live to The Leah Jansen Show every Monday morning at 10 a.m., 9 a.m. Central on TogiNet.com.
People think I've made it. I'm popular. I seem happy all the time. I have great clothes and I'm involved in everything. But I have questions, doubts, and fears, just like every other teenager. That's why I'm glad for Teen Talk Radio, where it's all about choices.
Join us for Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell, Thursday nights at 10, 9 Central on TogiNet.com.
the choices we have to make that can alter the course of our lives. Life is too much pressure if we try to go it alone. I tune in to Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell every week to get reminded that I'm not alone. Nicole Odell is an expert on what happens in the lives of teenagers. Join her as she deals with topics like peer pressure, purity, drugs, alcohol, and many other things that might come up along the way. She writes books and speaks to people all over the place, but she says her favorite moments are when she can pull up a chair and chat with teens about what's important to us.
For more information on Nicole and her books, go to NicoleOdell.com. Then join us for Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell, Thursday nights at 10, 9 central on TogiNet.com.
Teen Talk Radio, where it's all about choices.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, 10 Million to 1, Refugee Resettlement, a How-To Guide. And the author is Jeffrey Kirk. And Jeff joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Jeff.
Hello.
Let me read what you've written about your book, 10 Million to 1. You say there are roughly 10 million refugees in the world today. These are people who have fled their home country for fear of their lives. This book describes how one small group can help one refugee family start over with a new productive life in the U.S. You call this a refugee settlement guide that shows how to welcome a refugee family and get them started on the path to a new and prosperous life. It details every task that must be accomplished and shared with others to keep the workload minimal for everyone. So you've done this, Jeff. You've been involved for how long in this process?
Well, since 2001, actually right before 9/11. It was September 7th, 2001 is when we got started.
Tell us a little bit about your start and then what you've done over the last 10 years.
All right. Well, in the beginning, we were presented with a need. I worked through our church here in Waukesha, Wisconsin. Somebody had approached us to ask if our church would be interested in helping a refugee family. And for some strange reason, I felt called to the task and tried to convince the powers that be at our church that we should get involved. And it was kind of received lukewarm. So what I did is I said, well, if I can put together a team that is willing to do this, would you give me the thumbs up? And that was wholeheartedly received. I think the original fear was that those who were making the decision would somehow have to be involved, and they didn't want more to do. But if I said I would put together a team, then obviously it would fit with a church kind of calling. So we got involved. I put together a team, and I said, we're doing this. And we took on our first family, which was they're from Bosnia. And they arrived here on September 7th, 2001, so 4 days before 9/11. And in fact, they were, at that point, living in our house. We didn't have an apartment for them yet, so we had them living in our house with us. And can you imagine the horror on their minds when they saw what was transpiring on 9/11? Here they had come from war to where they believed was safe, and now they're seeing essentially the war had followed them into our country. And we got out maps and we showed them, we're in Wisconsin, here's New York, this is a long way away, this is a terrorist act, it's one thing, it's horrific, yes, but you're safe in our house, in our community right now. And they, a few days after that, or at least within a week, we had an apartment. They moved out. They are amazingly successful in our community with mom and dad working, the kids in jobs. One of them's in college right now. They're just an outstanding family who's, if they're not all citizens at this point, at least I think everyone but the mom. I'm not sure if the mom is a citizen, but the rest of the family is at this point. So, wonderful success story.
Well, today we hear, of course, all the time in the news about illegal immigrants, coming across the border and taking advantage of the government system, the welfare system, but you're not talking about those people.
No, not at all. Refugees are fully documented legal immigrants. They actually have to go through quite a process to even get to our country. And once they're here, the day they arrive, they are authorized to work. So we can help them settle down and try to get a job and become productive, self-sufficient members of our society as quickly as possible.
And many of these people are fleeing their country.
Yeah, they all are. By definition, refugees are someone who have fled their country due to basically the fear that they'll be killed if they stay in their country. You know, everybody wants a home. Everybody longs for a place to call home. And to be so afraid of your home that you're willing to leave it and go to a neighboring country that probably isn't even interested in welcoming you requires a heck of a lot of motivating fear. So every refugee has basically fled their homeland. There are a few exceptions, but the vast majority are people who have fled in fear.
And that key word, fled, it's not just traveling or deciding that, oh, let's go live somewhere else. Like you say, they have gone through some terrible experiences. They may have been, the police may have come. They may have been beaten, their children assaulted. Maybe even, as you put it, you know, their neighbors may have been killed.
Yeah, absolutely. All of those things have been experienced by the families we've worked with.
So this how-to guide, how did this come about? How did you see this? What was the genesis of all this?
Well, back in 2001, when we helped our first family, my attitude, although very generous toward this one family, was that we would help this one family and we'd be done. And it worked out very nicely. We had a successful experience. It wasn't always easy, but things came together and the result was success. And then we thought, okay, yay, pat ourselves on the back. About a year later, another request came into us and said, well, you know, you guys did a good job with that first family. Would you take another? I thought, oh, man, I never thought about taking another family on. But, well, can you tell us anything about this family? Well, it's a mom and five children from Afghanistan, and they really need someone. They're coming to this area, and we don't have anyone who can help them out. It's like, well, you know what? I'll ask my team, see if they want to participate again. And every one of them said yes. So we started rolling our process again. We looked back at, well, what are the things we all did the first time around, and can we do those same things again? And we did. This was actually, in my mind, a more difficult case because we thought we knew what we were doing because we had successfully done it once. And so we thought, oh, this is just going to be easy. But what we learned was it's a completely different family with completely different circumstances and personalities, and it wasn't easy. We fortunately had the first experience down and knew what we were doing from that, but we got new experiences. And that piled on to say, okay, well, there are additional things that need to be covered to be successful. Meanwhile, we're seeing other groups in our area who are working with refugees just really, really struggling. And they're asking us for help because they're not making a very good go of it at all. And so we're giving them our experience, and it's helping. And so I start thinking, well, what is it that we're doing that is leading us to be successful? And I started documenting it. I started writing it down because I'm thinking, well, this is family number two, and maybe there'll be a third someday. So rather than starting over fresh, let's have something written. So I started capturing details. And when family number three came along, it was a situation where we hadn't even volunteered. There was just a need to put a family up in temporary housing. And my wife and I said, well, we've had two families before live with us before we got an apartment. Let's have a third. So they moved in, and we thought they're not getting sufficient help. They don't have a team helping them. So at that point, we raised our hand. They were already here, and we said, we'll take them on as a third case. And we really got to test out then a lot of the things that we had previously put together. And that's how it evolved. With every family coming along, I could expand upon our knowledge base and what needs to be done. And that's, over the course of 8 families in the last 10 years, that's how it all came together.
Well, about a quarter of your book in Chapter 4 talks about tasks and responsibility. And here's this whole team approach, and I love it because, of course, you identify the need for a chairperson or co-chairpersons, but then you have the housing team, the furnishings team, food team, clothing team, medical care team, employment team, education team, transportation team, finance team, and public relations team. So it is quite a team effort, you know, obviously team together, everyone achieves more kind of an approach.
Well, absolutely. There are a number of fears people have when getting involved in refugee resettlement, and a team takes care of a lot of those fears because the tasks can be divided. And so you can go in with some advanced planning and saying, okay, you know what, I'm interested in being involved in food and clothing, and somebody else is interested in education, and someone else is they can handle money well. And so you can divide the tasks that need to be done along people's own areas of enjoyment and personality.
Yeah, their expertise.
Yeah. And so I strongly recommend having a team of at least 10 people. 15 is better. Have less than 5 and you're probably setting yourself up for some pain.
You're going to get overwhelmed, right? Yes.
Yeah.
Well, how
and
do
that's
you...
where we would see failures is when there have been like teams of one just 2 or 3 people trying to take this on. And, you know, unless you have full-time availability, you can't do it. And we've done everything we've done as on the outside of our regular lives.
Right. How do you really get refugees to be self-sufficient within 6 months?
Well, that's a real good question. We just talked about it, by putting together a team who are willing to take on one of these various 11 components that you recently read. And then the book goes into details about what each of those sub-teams needs to do. There's a checklist of every task that needs to be accomplished. And most of the work, the bulk of the work, is really done within the first 3 months. So 6 months is totally reasonable. The hard part, if I want to call it the hard part, the part that takes the longest is getting the job. Because a family isn't truly self-sufficient until they're bringing in their own money. So toward the end, after that 3 month time period, so in the 4 to 6 months, and sometimes it takes longer, but that's really the area where the focus is on employment. And once that job is acquired, that's celebration time, because they're on their own. They've figured everything else out. They know how, but usually before that job comes, they know how to get to the grocery store and buy their food. They know how to get around. They've met other people that can help them out. They don't have to be dependent upon their refugee resettlement team anymore. All of these things have come to play. So when that job hits, they're successful.
I guess that this just adds to the statement or the question of who is my neighbor?
Yes, yes.
You know, and the Christian directive of love your neighbor as yourself.
Mm-hmm. And how far do you carry
right
the definition of neighbor?
Exactly.
And, you know, some people truly, the neighbor is the person that lives next door.
Right.
And that's okay. That's not necessarily a wrong definition. My definition of neighbor is basically anyone that shares this planet. So, you know, for me, if there's an opportunity to reach out and help someone within reason, I certainly don't think I can reach out and help everyone in the world. That's absurd. But there are people that cross into my realm of influence, and when they do, it's possible to help them out.
We have just a couple of minutes remaining. What stops people from getting involved?
Mostly fear. There are basically three fears that people have with regard to refugee resettlement. They're afraid, I kind of sum it up this way, they're afraid they might break the refugees, they're afraid the refugees are already broken, or they're afraid that somehow the refugees will break them. And what I mean by this, that they'll break the refugees, is they think refugees are fragile people, and that they might, that they, the volunteer, might do something wrong and screw things up. And that's just not going to happen. The second fear that the refugees are already broken is that the fear that they're messed up beyond help. And, you know, there are some cases that are tough, but the volunteers don't have to fix that. There's agencies and social services and things out there to take on that role. And the last one is the big one, though, that the refugees will break the volunteers. And we see that in the excuses. Well, I don't know what to do. It's going to take too long. It's going to cost too much. And that's where this book comes into play. It's really about overcoming the fears that people have about themselves. We talk about exactly what they need to do, how long it's going to take, how much it's going to cost. All that's estimated in there so that people know what they're getting into when they get started.
Got about 30 seconds. How do you define a successful resettlement?
Well, a successful resettlement is self-sufficiency, when they can take care of themselves and they're a contributing member of our society. So they're not dependent on the resettlement team, and certainly the resettlement team is not dependent on them. They're able to let go, and the family can operate as their own family unit here in the U.S.
The title of the book, 10 Million to One, Refugee Resettlement, A How-To Guide, and the author is Jeffrey Kirk. Jeff, tell us how to get your book.
You can head on over to www.10milliontoone.com. Real easy.
Real easy. All right. 10milliontoone.com. Jeff, thanks for being with us on Indie Book Publishing and this interview brought to everyone by Balboa Press. Thanks, Jeff.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.